Ash Sharp, welcome to the program.
Hi, Lana. Thanks for having me on.
So tell us about Republic Standard, because you are new to the scene, shall I say.
Yeah, for sure. It was about a year or so back. I started writing on Medium, and I got a little bit of traction, got a few shares from Paul Joseph Watson for an article about Harvey Weinstein coming out and doing his stuff. And I started writing on Medium because my missus was getting bored of me like talking to her about it. So after that article got, like, you know, had quite a lot of traction, I wrote another one. I thought, you know, it was just a flash in the pan kind of thing. And I wrote a piece about Poland's Independence Day that was, you know, tarred in the media as being, you know, far right Nazi stuff. And I know Poland quite well. My wife to be is Polish.
Nice.
I was like, well, that's just not true. How can you write this stuff? You don't know what you're talking about. And then that one blew up as well. I was like, oh, maybe I'm okay at this. So through that, I started talking to a few political Discord servers. And through those, I started speaking to a chap who had a website and needed an editor and needed a webmaster. And that put me and the webmaster that I now work with at Republic Standard together. And though that first project fell on its ass, this one seems to be doing quite well. So we've been going since the 8th of January. We've had well in excess of 100,000 page views. We like to bitch. Excuse my.
You can say whatever you want. It's okay. No censorship here.
We like to pitch ourselves as a conservative magazine of thought and culture. And that basically means it's broadly right-wing, although I have offered a right of reply to leftists as well. And even if people on the left want to write, if they can make a good argument, I think what we're really missing in the media and why we're doing quite well with our traffic, at least, is that people are missing out someone who's willing to look for answers, looking to actually not just push, well, okay, this is why this is happening, and if you don't believe it, then you're a racist or a communist or whatever. I mean, we'll go quite in depth into the philosophies that underpin a lot of the actions and ideas that are taking place in this crazy world that we live in now.
Now, how did you find yourself here? Because I know you're relatively new. You were leftist, anarchist, all that stuff. So tell us a little bit about your transition.
Yeah, for sure. I was well on the left for most of my life and not really engaged. You know, there's a lot of, I think it's quite true that a lot of people who are on the left are thinking that they're politically activated, but in fact are either regurgitating easy to swallow ideologies, like, you know, liberal leftism in general is kind of like, you know, well, everybody's kind of the same, and there's no connection between things like race and IQ, and immigration has no problem, and, you know, these kind of ideas are very easy to just accept and go, okay, well, that's the way the world is, and if you don't agree with that, well, there's an awful lot of racists in the world, aren't there? When I started making a few YouTube videos and started thinking about these kind of things a little bit more clearly, like, I actually, like, first got into this. I dated a feminist for a very short period of time. I was like, whoa.
I'm sure that was very short. Very short.
That's what you guys really—that's what you guys really believe. Holy crap! I was always kind of, well, okay, I don't really like neoliberal economics very much, but that was always more of my critique of late capitalism as a whole, rather than any social issue. And then once I got started being educated, well, first of all, this lass said, "Well, you believe in equality, don't you?" I was like, oh, "I don't know." Maybe. I said, well, if you do, you're a feminist. I'm like, that sounds like nonsense to me, love. Yes. So I went away and started reading a few things, and I was like, yeah, this is crazy. I'm having no part of that. And as I sort of progressed through from you making YouTube videos into writing articles and then onto looking deeper into things like neo-Marxism and what the leftists actually believe and what people who are on my kind of side of the political spectrum, where it's like, oh my God, I didn't actually know what the hell I was talking about. So where am I now? And I still think, like, if we're in a perfect human world, we could have, like, some kind of, you know, functional, collaborative, post-resource anarchy. But that's that would be dependent on humans not being human beings. We're tribal animals.
That's right.
And so once you start thinking about, okay, well, we are tribal animals, and a big part of it, actually, my recognition of this tribal aspect only came when I visited Poland for the first time. And really, it was thanks to the Poles and my future wife that taught me that it is actually okay to be proud of where you're from. Do not take this with, I'm not exaggerating. In England, national pride, national identity is considered to be basically for knuckle-dragging football fans, racists, and bigots. I mean, that's the programming, and it's strong as hell. And it wasn't until I'd seen the Poles how they live and what they've been through, and they retained their national identity and they basically, you know, held my hand a little bit. So it's okay to be English.
It's okay to like yourself. It's okay, Ash.
Right? Exactly. No word of a lie. I mean, you go, oh my God! Like, I thought it was just we were just the civic creation.
Now you left the UK. You're actually in Ibiza, Spain now. So when did that happen?
We've just passed 2 years.
Okay.
We just passed 2 years out here. It's a fantastic place to live. Can't fault it. It's just, the winters can be a little bit damp, but as you see from over my shoulder there, it's just past 8:30 in the evening.
By the Buddha, so which came with the house, right?
came with the house. I'm not a Buddhist.
Now, what made you want to leave the UK? Was it anything to do with the demographics?
No, actually, it was relatively just I was bored, you know, like I was bored of the politics going nowhere. And I had a friend who was living out here already. And she said, what are you doing out there? And so I was like, okay, that's actually a good point. And it was really like since I left England that you get out of the goldfish bowl and you can sort of start looking back at it and going, wow. Like I'm out of the day-to-day culture, but you still experience the media the same way, and it is really quite jarring. I think there's a friend of mine who's in Barcelona called Simon Harris, who is doing a lot of work into the JQ at the minute, and we've spoken quite a bit. Like, what is going on? Like, are we just being like radicalized by the internet? Because it doesn't feel like it. It feels like the homeland is going crazy. And the longer it goes on, I mean, particularly with, we'll get into Selma and Pettibone in a bit, I'm sure, but that was just, oh my, it is just such a black pill for us. I think we've literally broken through into an overt police state, which is honestly quite terrifying. And it hurts. Like considering where I was on this kind of lack of English identity, to have gained the English identity and then immediately be so blackpilled on the state, it's really quite emotionally painful quite a lot of ways.
It's kind of funny how you almost had to leave it to find it. And now you're looking back and, oh my gosh, like we had said, you know, London has fallen. So let's talk about London. Have you visited there recently? What can you tell us about the demographics? It's now the most multicultural city in the world. I think it's also number one for rapes and murder and all kinds of violence and theft and burglaries.
It's rape, knife crime, acid attacks. It's now 45% white British, which is interesting. I actually did get a source the other day. Earlier today, crime stats. Let's have a look. On just about everything, we are up. Total robbery up 33% year on year. Personal robbery up 34%. Business robbery up 25%. Total theft is up 35%. Knife crime's up 31%. Knife crime with injury is up 20%. Hate crime. Islamophobic hate crime is up 26%. This is reports to the police, at least. Anti-Semitic hate crime is at 5% and a bit. Faith hate crime, which I guess is, I don't know whether, I'm pretty sure that doesn't include Islamophobia because that's now basically classed the same as racism. All in all, with with London, I keep getting into discussions with English people, and I know London quite well from a very early age. I was visiting the capital city, and I remember from the 80s being a very different place. And I'm still talking to people today, going like, guys, but the demographic shift, you're like, our culture is contingent on the demography. You have to have the Britons, which is our people, our ethnicity, to have the culture of the Britons, right? And you go, well, no. So, okay, so why not? And I say, well, you can just be a citizen, can't you? I said, well, okay, but if you're a citizen of a country, that doesn't mean you hold the values. You don't like Yorkshire pudding and tea. If you right, like you wouldn't say, right, if the New Zealanders turned on the Maoris, who are actually a far younger culture in New Zealand than my people are in England, and they started like kicking the crap out of the Maoris, what would you feel about this? Oh, well, that's not the same, is it? I can understand the problem because, you know, I felt it myself. And you are conditioned into this belief in that Britishness doesn't exist, which I think is incredibly sad. And we now have the expression of our national identity in football, this kind of thing, you know. It's really quite surprising once you move out of the goldfish bowl to have a look back at your homeland. And
I mean, geez, the English people have brought so much to the world, so many good things to the world that people forget when it comes to explorers and discoveries and inventions. I mean, we could just go on and on. The list is endless, really, of what the English people have brought the world.
Well, I mean, I don't tie into any kind of supremacist ideology, but for sure, I mean, we conquered most of the planet, left most of the planet a lot better than when we found it. But now we're unable to have our own identity because I think one of the main theses behind what I write about is the idea that Western civilization and England and Britain is particularly an egregious example of this. Canada as well. America may be on its way, depending on how the next few years with Mr. Donald go. But we've developed, instead of a vibrant and exploratory culture that came with, you know, the problems of building empires and these kind of things, and of course, World War I and World War II were effectively the clashes of these empires and the remnants left behind. But instead, we made this kind of maternal culture, which is to say, like when Nietzsche predicted everything that's going on with our societies, he said, right, what you're doing is you're going to replace God, because I've just killed God, even though I understand it very well. And atheists today do not understand their own religion in any way. The religions that they're against. They just said, well, no God, lol. And what we did to replace God is we made the state as God and came up with fascism. And we made the society as God and came up with communism. And then we made like ourselves as God with, you know, consumer capital. And we're still a bit in that. But what we've been shifting towards is making the minority as God. So this is the intersectional Marxist philosophy where you're defined by your arbitrary characteristics, and it's kind of the hierarchy of power. So we made this maternal society that will coddle and mother like a baby anyone who is not of the default, i.e. the white Briton. So instead of, you know, treating people as adults and saying, okay, well, you are bringing in your culture with you and you'll integrate, as we thought in the 50s and 60s, we then go, well, okay, well, you're going to bring in your culture and we're going to live in this multicultural, and we'll all get along happily, but we won't be integrated. And now that idea has been blown out of the water. So we're now being told we're all going to integrate again. But the problem is that we now have the crime of having hate. It's, well, you're going to hate something. you can't legislate against emotions. We can understand why these emotions occur, but when we have this this pathologized mothers, I mean, you're a new mother yourself. The emotion you feel towards your own child is incredibly intense. So now we have this state that is bound ideologically to defend the children, which are perfectly rational and intelligent human beings acting in their own interest and in their own in-group interest. And we have the state that now protects that. So what we're going to see going forward as the demographic shifting further is just the exploitation of the UK by outsider groups, which I think is a really, really bad idea.
You think and so? I know. Crime, violence is happening. You wrote a good article about this on Republic Standard. And some of the excuses that we hear is, oh, well, it's been happening for centuries, or it's part and parcel of living in the city, blaming the internet for terrorism, or that nationalists drove all these people to hate and violence, or, you know, blaming those evil racist English people for egging it on. What are your thoughts on this?
Right, okay, so this is some of the craziest stuff. I mean, when we talk about immigration, we say, oh, well, we've been immigrating for thousands of years. So I was like, okay, well, that sounds interesting. Has that actually been happening? And no, it hasn't. we had a case called, it was called Cheddar Man, which was an old skeleton.
Well. Yes.
Oh, you know it.
Yeah, we did a special on that.
Right, but I missed that one, so excuse me if I rehash anything that you came up with. But really, they decided that this Western hunter-gatherer, which is a pre-civilization of about 10,000 years ago, was a skeleton found in the UK. And because it was missing a couple of genetic clusters that indicate whiteness, they decided he must have been dark-skinned, and he may well have been. However, that does not make him a Briton, because my people, my distant ancestors, are from something called the Belbeca civilization that moved into Western Europe about 6,000 years ago, so, and displaced the Western hunter-gatherers. And there's the genes for blonde hair and blue eyes that comes from Russia as well. The blue eyes of the Cheddar Man may have got into the genetic mix-up as well. But this was latched onto and held up as some kind of proof that there is no such thing as race, and that actually British people were black first. But Britain as a concept comes much later.
Yeah.
Of course, you can't immigrate to into a place where there's no nation. You're just moving around what is just land. So through that, I started looking into other aspects of genetics, and there's haplogroups that are very clearly defined within white British, the overarching ethnicity that I and my people come from. And if you have four grandparents born in Britain, like prior to 1945, then most of your DNA will be from about a 100-mile area in most likelihood, and will be identifiable up to about 1600 years ago. So we are not only a very static society, we were very resistant to change. We almost had zero genetic impact from the Vikings, because they also kept to their own in-group when they took over land in the 7th and 8th centuries. They hardly interbred with us at all. And then you move through time and go, okay, so there's about 50,000 Huguenots who came over from France in the 18th, 19th century, not quite sure of the date. And that was kind of a big deal. But apart from that, there was hardly any immigration at all up until the post-war period. And then we start seeing, we were bringing in our colonial subjects to replace the manpower that we lost during World War II. But we kept changing our rules and changing our minds on what we wanted to do with immigration, and no one really thought about what the upshot was. I'm sure you've covered Enoch Powell before. Mm-hmm. He undersold it. His expectations were far surpassed, but he was denounced as a racist and a bigot and so on. But everything he said came true, And then you have Nick Griffin in with the British National Party, who was gaining some ground in the early 2000s even. But then he goes on television and his views are exposed, well, say exposed, quite reasonable in hindsight. And so the press do their thing and say, well, this guy's clearly a racist. There is absolutely no problem with immigration. Shut up, go away. So we've ended up with a modern system that is utterly dependent on immigration being a general good. If we cannot even bring to consider that that there's some or many aspects of immigration that are at the root cause of many of the ills of our country. And particularly after the Labour government of the late 90s and early 2000s, when it was literally just throw open the borders, let people come in. And then we stopped marking, or we stopped registering when people left. We have no idea how many people were in. We had no idea on how many people were leaving. And the we have a census every 10 years in the United Kingdom. We last had one in 2011, and the next one is 2021, and it is going to be a bombshell. I guarantee it.
Well, what's so crazy about this is, you know, England has no room. It's crowded. You drive through England, and it's like there's farms, there's people, the cities are growing. At what point is it enough? I mean, seriously.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, my people's birth rate is, we reckon, about 1.6 to 1.8, which is lower than the rate of replacement. However, we are told that we need to build a house every couple of minutes to cope with the booming population. And we still took in 200,000 immigrants in the last year, and that was considered a good reduction, you know. So what the problem is for a lot of white British people to really comprehend what is going on is they don't live in the areas affected by the diversity. So when your immigrants arrive, they go for London, they go for Birmingham, they go for other larger towns and cities. But it's not until these people will overspill just through overcrowding into what areas have already been abandoned by white people some time ago that we're really going to recognize it. There's a town in Lancashire called Blackburn that is already in effective apartheid. There is half the town that is Pakistani Muslim, majority, and the other half is white British. And we know about this. We make TV shows about it. But no one cares. Well, we go like, well, okay, so what? Guys, so what? You're being demographically replaced.
Exactly. They can be Pakistani in Pakistan. They have a country that's all their own people if that's what they want.
We do not have, well, my people do not have an Israel. Neither does France, neither does any other country. Exactly. So this is the one you have to live in. How you live, like, I have absolutely no problem with some level of migration.
Yeah, right? Small levels, as long as you remain the majority.
Yeah, well, yes, it's an ethno-maximalist kind of position there. I wrote another piece a while ago about the necessary intersection between your civic national rights that you come up with as a culture and your ethnicity, your ethno-nationalism, your ethno-state, if you will. You have to have your rights based on the ethnicity. That's true of everywhere. I'm sure you've heard this one a lot, but like, you can't just take away all the Japanese people, replace them with English people, and then you're going to have a tea ceremony. What's that? You're going to make manga? It makes no sense. It's delusional. But there is something that I'm not quite getting yet about my countrymen, and it's how to bridge this gap. I've been on the left for so long.
If you were on the left for so long, did you think that, oh, England deserves this for their colonial past, so we should just open the borders and anyone should come and take anything they want and live wherever they want because of our evil colonialism?
Not quite so in such strong terms. It's not quite in such strong terms. You do think like, part of the rudiments of terrorism is kind of some kind of retribution for the war on terror and our imperialism overseas. And you think, well, okay, well, we did have colonialism, so immigration is going to happen. But this is a very shallow understanding. It's literally just the meme. We did have India and we did have bits of Africa, so we're probably going to see Indians and Africans here. And until you start actually paying attention to it, and only then it becomes like, oh, this is bad, and this is going to get very bad. Now, the worst case scenario for me, the absolute worst case, is for my people to remain ignorant until a point where the lie goes on and we don't have the necessary education to avoid total violence. Because English people are very good at fighting. Really good at that.
The only way I see this going down for the future of the UK or England to remain English is a repatriation. They just have to go back. That's what's going to have to happen. Peaceful repatriation.
I wish it wasn't so. I really do. It absolutely saddens me that I've only come to this position by following evidence. You know, once you start going, right, okay, well, let's actually look at the evidence. Let's check the evidence. Holy crap. I was joining the anti-Nazi league at 14. And I was incredibly against like any kind of right-wing philosophy. I mean, out of most cultures apart from the Germans themselves, I think we have such antipathy in England for the Nazis, because you know we have that kind of history with that ideology. But part of the problem with killing the Nazis off was, it's my contention that that was also used by certain interested parties to also kill off the idea of nationalism as a potential force of good, even though it really was nationalist nations that took down the Nazis. Well, yeah. Nationalist nations and also the communists.
It's a brotherly war that never should have happened, and a third party really gained from that. None of us gained anything from that.
For sure. I mean, particularly when I look at the nation of Poland. I mean, we sold them down the river, but that war, if it had been handled tactically better when Germany entered Poland, I think if the English and French who were literally on the border of Germany at the time had gone, excuse me, Mr. Hitler, what are you doing? We're going to invade your Western Front right now. It would have pulled back in, and I think maybe it had gone a different way. Who knows? In any case, the upshot was destruction. The most important thing for our future relations in Europe, we have to end the European Union. That has to go.
Exactly. People misinterpret that all the time. When I say pro-European, I don't mean pro-European Union, because the European Union is actually very anti-white. They hate nationalists. They want open borders. They are not our friends. So I always have to clarify that with people. Pro-European is not European Union.
Correct. The European Union is absolutely nothing to do with European people. Yeah. It is a corporatist entity. It was a trading bloc that has gone out of control. They now want their own army. Why does the EU need an army? Who knows? It's nothing good, that's for sure. If we can reinvigorate the nations of particularly France, Germany, and Great Britain with at least, if not like nationalism per se, I mean, I'm not anticipating any of these countries to run back to a nationalist identity, but at least some sense of national identity, some sense of self-interest, and also recognizing that that Europe itself, we're all based on the same four pillars, Christian theology, Greek philosophy, Roman law, and modern science. Everything else, or the differences between our cultures, I think maybe the Finns are a little bit different thanks to their unique ethnic heritage, but all the other cultures, we're all standing on these four pillars, and then we've got the other bits that come into it. There's the more Volkish kind of people in the north, and there's the remnants of the Moorish culture in the south. But generally, we're all Europeans, and it doesn't matter what your genetic heritage is, because we're looking at ourselves. I mean, how crazy is this? Right? We're looking at ourselves in our cultures going, Yeah, but what about the transgenders?
I
What
know,
are we
it's
going to do
ridiculous.
about that? Meanwhile, China is going, well, okay, we're going to make some of the most amazing technological developments the planet has ever seen, and we're coming your way in the next 10 years. Like, guys, yeah, we've got a, we, there is
We're literally
not.
fighting for the right for guys to cut off their peepees, you know? It's just insanity. Yeah, we should be going to the stars. Yes.
Well, as a culture, why the hell not? Why are we not doing those things? And we go, well, okay, well, we've got all this power imbalance. Sort your power imbalance. Like, the worst thing that we've done as a culture has been adopting this neo-Marxist ideology. It's made us weak and stupid. And it doesn't mean that before that we were racist and bad and horrible people and that women were oppressed. Like, I've just finished the book by Michel Houellebecq, Submission, which is fantastic. And the story in that is it's a slightly futurist satire novel. It's 2022, and the Muslim Brotherhood win the general election in France. And towards the end of the book, he's reading a critique by a Muslim convert who's a professor of literature. And he says, look, the problem with Western civilization was that you became too feminine. Christianity itself gives you your sense of morals, your human rights, and things like this, which is all well and good. But when it's pathologized, you become too weak. This femininity expresses itself in this neo-Marxist kind of idea. And then when that critique goes, right, okay, we're going to go through the organizational structures of your society and critique those. That's okay. You can handle it. When it gets to the family, and you go, well, okay, now you don't need children. Demographic death.
Yeah,
that's
well,
where we're at.
You know, these Marxists are also cool with pedophilia and child abuse, because you had the Telford, you know, child sex abuse ring not being fully investigated like Rotherham. I mean, between those two big, it's an epidemic there in the UK now, you know, foreigners raping young kids, grooming them, drugging them, beating them, raping them. It was like 3,000 victims, some girls as young as 11, covering this up because it's racist to point out who's doing the raping. So they're cool with pedophiles.
It's far more damaging than that. I mean, we are working on estimates, and these estimates come from Labour Party MP called Sarah Champion. She estimates up to 1 million young girls over the last 40 years, and we are seeing these Pakistani Muslim grooming gangs in almost every major city. There's two in Oxford that were unearthed. So. What we're specifically looking at here, there's a difference between child sexual exploitation, which is a crime we call it in the UK. And on the one hand, you have type one, which is your archetypal paedophile in the playground kind of mentality. And that seems, according to prosecution data, to follow along with the demographic. So most of these are white British men. Okay. But when we look at type two, which is sex gangs of men, then we see 85% of, well, about this, according to Quilliam, which are an anti-extremist organization actually run by a Muslim, Majid Nawaz, 85% of type two, which is the grooming gangs, is from Pakistani Muslims. Now, when we think, if the assessment of the number of victims is true, about 1 million over the last 40 years. And today, as of 2011, there was 1.1 million Pakistanis in the country, which leaves us with about, you know, 500,000 or 600,000 Pakistani men and slightly less than that of males who are sexually active. This is an incredible volume. It's mind-blowing that we are seeing this level of sexual abuse of mainly underage girls, and partly the problem has been because the police have been afraid to be called racist. Partly it's been a failure to address that this is not specifically a trouble with Islam, but it is a problem within the Pakistani Muslim community, because they have a code of brotherhood. I forget the Badriri, I believe, is the word. But this is a culturally significant factor that they have in their homeland. And this extends through their politics, through their work. It's basically nepotism. But it's a I keep your secrets, you keep mine kind of affair. So that's twofold. And then we go into the class issue that we have in the United Kingdom too, where most of these girls are from working class, poor, white backgrounds. And it's if this was like a posh kid getting taken, the press would be on it like a shot. Mm-hmm. The liberal media would be going, oh my God, what are you doing? They still won't address any of the other issues, but it's a hellish combination. And a big part of it as well is it would not have been allowed to happen if our working class culture was stronger. I mean, I'm from the working class myself. My accent's changed a lot from my days in a Yorkshire mining town, but I grew up in a council estate. I'm from a single parent family. And there was the remnants of the working class white Britain's culture that I grew up in. I think that was the late 80s, early 90s. But we no longer have the familial bonds. We no longer have the culture, the cultural strength even, the recognition of where you are from, who is your neighbor, why these things are important. We no longer recognize this in ourselves, and that has left our children open to abuse over the last 40 years. And the state has done nothing. The law has done nothing. In fact, just yesterday, a slight tangent, but this is how we prosecute in the UK. We don't prosecute these kinds of crimes if we can possibly avoid it. But we have just arrested a 78-year-old man who was woken up by two intruders in his home. One of them was armed with a screwdriver and chased this old man into his kitchen. The old guy got a knife and killed his attacker in his own house. Bear in mind, these guys broke in. Our police arrested him. These arrested him on suspicion of murder.
Self-defense.
They broke into your house. Unless you're running out after them in the street and hacking them to pieces while they're running away, they brought it on themselves. And it doesn't really matter what race any of these people are. I have no other details other than the two guys are about 35. This guy gets woken up by his wife in the middle of the night, goes down to investigate, as you would, and ends up killing the guy who is armed already. So what do you do? You're just supposed to go, okay, well, can you just take whatever you want and please don't kill me? Our police no longer investigate crimes where the value of what has been stolen is less than £50. So what this means is, the theory is that this will leave the police more free, in London particularly, to investigate more serious crimes. That's not what happens, because now you have a criminal underclass, and it's mainly black males between the ages of 14 and 25, who are now immune from prosecution for shoplifting or mugging. And they're also quite often armed, either with knives or acid. So you go, okay, excuse me, Mr. Officer, I've just been threatened with a knife and I've been mugged. Well, okay, how much was in your wallet? 50 quid. We're never going to catch him, son. Okay, we'll take your name and details and that's it. Off you go.
Yeah, and then these criminals know that and then they keep doing it because they keep getting away with it. They know it.
Well, wouldn't you? I can empathize in the sense that we have an underclass, particularly of Afro-Caribbean and African origin men, which is getting exacerbated by the entrance of more. This is the worst part of the whole migrant issue. When you're talking to people on the left, is look, you're talking about the minorities that we already have, the British minorities, the British citizens, who mainly live in the inner cities, and they are feeling the effects of this migrant crisis and the most recent open borders wave more than anyone. And you speak to most third, second generation Indians, even a lot of Pakistanis, why are we taking in more people? We there's no room as it is where we are. But then you're bringing in ethnic conflict between the minorities as well. So you're going to have, say, Sudanese, Afghanis, Romanian even, from Eastern Europe. We have a spate of crime that comes from there too. And they will compete with each other for the rights to be a criminal. So it really does damage the ability of the minorities that may be like second or third generation in the major cities to get a leg up to start contributing. I mean, if you can go, okay, so I'm in school, 15 years old, I'm not going to get touched by the police, I'm already underage, I can carry a knife with relative impunity. If I'm arrested for something that's probably racist and no one's going to actually investigate the crimes that I am doing because I'm only doing petty thievery, what kind of citizen are you producing? That we just take race out of the equation. You put that in a white British town, in a white Swedish town or French town, it doesn't matter. If you are going, okay, here's the perfect encouragement for you to be a criminal, well, there's going to be a lot of kids who are going to take that up.
Yeah.
A lot of kids.
And they get welfare. You had mentioned earlier that, you know, England's identity has kind of become football. And I've been saying for so long, where are all these football lads? Why aren't they, you know, protesting in the streets? Why aren't they getting mad? Why aren't they fighting back against mass immigration and a lot of these politics? Well, finally, we saw some football lads protesting the whole Telford scandal. I'm sure you know about this. And it's just interesting because they were protesting gang rape and pedophiles. Okay. And then you had lefties showing up protesting them, calling them racist. I mean, this is mind blowing to me.
That's a beautiful thing. As you see on the camera here, yeah, that is mainly white people. That's made like football fans are majority white. But the interesting thing about this march, this was the Democratic Football Lads Alliance. And you have several interesting things going on. Firstly, this is an incredible movement anyway, all branches of it. They've had some infighting and some fractions, but it is quite incredible to see football fans who despise each other, quite frankly, breaking that barrier and coming together for something bigger. But this march in particular was interesting because there was a chap called Mo Fayaz, who I've spoken to once or twice. He's an apostate from Islam. He's quite vocal about his opposition to Islam. Next to him was members of the Sikh community have also suffered terribly at the hands of these Pakistani grooming gangs. And there's also representations from the Muslim community who are sick of, you know, the Pakistani grooming gangs. And even there's some Pakistanis within that saying this is a horrible thing. We've got to get it out of our culture. So you've got all these people marching together. They're entirely peaceful. There's a heavy police presence. And then they're met by like 40 socialists, all white, going, Nazi scum off our streets. Like, what are you on about? what do you mean by Nazi scum? It's like, the entire MO of the Football Lads Alliance is against extremism, and they're also working with a group called Veterans Against Terrorism, who are, you know, fairly self-explanatory. But they're against like terrorism of all sorts, or even against the extreme far right. And to be honest, we do have a incredible minority of violent extremists on the far right, and if they're going to be blowing people up, then yeah, they should be opposed as well. But as you've got on the screen there, we've got working class people which cling on to the only identity that they've got, and it's a great idea to bring the football fans together, but no one wants to pay attention to that. They want to strip that identity from us as well, I guess. And even in the local press for, I think there was a march in Birmingham that predated this one slightly, there was a Asian origin journalist who posted a picture on Twitter of two fans. They are in their 40s. They are fat, white, bald, ugly men. one's from Newcastle and one's from Sunderland. And you think about some of the most extreme and bitter rivalry that you can. I mean, this rivalry between Newcastle and Sunderland goes deep. It goes into when they were shipbuilding towns. They calls them the Mackem and the Tackem. Them's at Mackem and them's at Tackem. Those that build the ships and those that take the ships. This rivalry is deep. And these two men are shaking hands. What does this journalist say? Well, this is just the example of the football lads alliance that we expect, isn't it? And you go, why? Well, why is that? Is it because of their race? Is it because they are bald white men? What's your problem here? What are you defending? Why are you defending it? Like, cause there seems to be such an immediate push. I mean, I wrote about this for the Red Elephants when the first march came on. I was like, these people aren't extremists at all. What are you talking about? But that's been the push from day one.
It's also absurd too that it's considered extreme for a bunch of European guys, English guys in particular, to say, you know, England is for the English. It's for us. Our ancestors built it. That has become, far right extremism. I know these guys are working up to it, and I know they liked to represent, you know, some of the Sikhs and the Muslims and stuff. And I get what they're going for there, but I hope that they can work up to the bravery to feel that they don't need that they could just take their own side and say, you know, what's wrong with us wanting our country to be for our people?
And I don't think there's going to be too much pushback. I mean, like unlike the liberal elite, I think most people, regardless of race, would say, okay, well, if the English said, right, okay, well, this is for us, there's going to be some tough talk on immigration, at least, and that's generally how you'd have to move in towards any kind of say deportation kind of policy. But to even get to a status of, right, okay, well, this is England, this is based on our wishes, and we are quite happy for you to be here so long as you behave yourself, please stop raping our children. That would be a start, yeah. You know. But if you can't get the mainstream media on side with, can you please stop blowing our children up in Manchester? And I think that's one of the most abhorrent things. If I can just briefly riff on that, is we have 22 kids annihilated with a nail bomb at a pop concert, and within a couple of days, we're going, well, how can we fight hate? We'll sing John Lennon and Oasis, and have a candlelight vigil, and then we're really the most bizarre one of them. I don't really want to try and conflate the two tragedies, because there was another tragedy in London where a tower block it got incinerated, and it was mainly populated by illegal immigrants, unfortunately, and a very recent arrivals to the country, and this took over the narrative for the rest of the year. Like, it's very, very strange when we go, okay, so we can have three terrorist attacks in the space of 12 months, and we can't criticize Islam for it because that would be Islamophobic, and you know, that's a hate crime now. But if a tower block goes up, then we must have a month-long investigation. There's people on the left side of politics saying, well, why are white men running this investigation into what happened at Grenfell Tower? What does it matter?
Yeah.
Can we find out why this tower burnt down and killed so many people? Oh, no, we see it's about race and class.
Yeah, I know. Hey, I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on censorship in the UK, the barring of identitarians. You've seen, Martin Selner, Richard Spencer, Brittany Pettibone, many others. What goes through your mind when this is happening?
Well, when Selner and Pettibone were stopped at the border, I mean, that was incredibly disheartening. I was, up until that point, I don't even think I would have gone so far to say, right, okay, identitarianism is necessary. I would have said, right, okay, well, they've got their opinions and they're kind of welcome to them, and maybe they got some good ideas to bring. After that, I was like, right, okay, my country is a police state. I wrote an article saying Britain's a police state. And I immediately got incredibly wasted because it was heartbreaking. The idea that we are barring people as mild as Brittany Pettibone, Lauren Southern's on a lifetime ban for trolling Muslims.
Outrageous.
It's like, what are we doing? Well, we had Anjem Chowdhury, who was a literal hate preacher who recruited for ISIS on the taxpayer's dime in a large house with a big family, and we paid for all of it for many years. And we are scared of like a
22-year-old girl. Yeah.
What are you doing? It's mind-boggling. I mean, for the viewers who, I'm sure you all saw that one too, printed out leaflet saying Allah is gay in response to an article in Vice that said Jesus was probably a homosexual. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so she was like deliberately trolling people, but surely that's the point. That is, you are looking for the edge. Like, that's what an edgy comic is. I mean, it's also just a meme, so you know, so edgy. I mean, literally the cusp of what is publicly acceptable before you go into outright insults, which stops being funny, stops being entertaining. That is the edge. That's what you're looking at. That's what you're exploring. I have a couple of visits to the UK coming up. Hopefully,
I mean, they don't like, see this show.
Well, I mean, in all honesty, I mean, I think I'll be okay for this year. After this year, I don't know whether I'll be able to go to my own country anymore. Well, I'll be able to go there, but will I be able to avoid being arrested?
Yeah, exactly. What would they do? Would they revoke your citizenship? I mean, seriously, I mean, is that what's going to happen to Tommy Robinson eventually here? And kick him out altogether?
Well, we'll see after Brexit, because that could make some very interesting things. Because the Tories kind of said that we want to get out of it wasn't the Tories per se. It was part of the Brexit kind of the Leave campaign. Was we don't want to be tied to the European Commission of Human Rights. And on the left, it was kind of, oh my God, they're going to revoke human rights from everybody. It wasn't that at all. It's just a little bit too. It was things like the right to a family life that is very broad in European terminology, which says, well, okay, it's kind of like the chain migration that you have in the United States. Same kind of thing. They wanted to sort that so we could control the borders a little better. What could happen, though, I think it'd be a long shot, but I believe it's the United Nations Court of Human Rights says that you cannot make someone stateless. And that's a big problem with any kind of future deportation strategy in the UK. To be honest, I think you need to make it simply less viable for migrants to access the country and those delicious benefits, or revoke those for first generation migrants or some such program there. But if the UK went full cyber Nazi, so right, okay guys, we're gonna revoke your citizenship, that could happen. I don't see it as being a likely thing, but the state's not gonna kick Tommy Robinson out. God knows what they're going to try and do to the poor guy. I mean, fair play. I mean, tell you what, it is how the programming goes. For many years, I didn't pay attention to really what he said. You say, oh, okay, he's in the English Defence League and they're racists, right? Okay. But yeah, it's just, you just kind of buy the narrative a little bit. And then over time, when you start, like, you know, looking at what he's actually said and done, you know, like burning the Nazi battle standard and like literally being hounded out of the English Defence League by the far right. And the EDL really did get co-opted by some people who were operating from a position of bigotry, I think, rather than the genuine concern that people like Tommy Robinson had. And when you realise, oh my God, I was part of this, It's kind of heartbreaking. You think, like, well, and look about the, once you see what the state is actually doing to the guy. I mean, social media has been one of the great breakthroughs for Tommy, because now he can live stream whenever someone's interviewing him, and it stops the selective editing, shall we say, and he can just come out and say, oh, look, this is real. And he's had to become a journalist to put his ideas across. And all power to him.
And it's just simple, basic kind of no shit kind of truths, you know. It's just amazing. Yeah. that is so edgy anymore. It's just outrageous.
That's the conditioning, man. That's the conditioning. I mean, like, when they go, right, okay, well, Martin Selner, you may not enter the United Kingdom because you are from a right-wing organization. And? Oh, well, no, that's enough now for the state to prevent you from entering.
Yep.
Okay, well, how, like JFK said, when you make peaceful revolution impossible, you make violent revolution inevitable. And we are stamping out the very ideas that need to be tackled. And what I write a lot in Republic Standard is like, guys, if you can show me that I'm wrong, I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to go, oh my God, you leftard. Like, yeah, I'm going to learn something. And I wish I was wrong about all this. I mean, I really wish the happy clappy socialists were right, but they're not. And here we are. I mean, like, if we could all just get along as one big happy global family, wouldn't that be nice if it was just a Coke advertisement world, you know? Yeah, and there would be no need for any of this. But then you go, well, okay, that's not how humans work. That's not how humans are. And when the British state says, okay, there's some ideas that are too dangerous for you to hear. And from Martin Selner's speech, I'll paraphrase a little bit. He's saying, look, you are the people of like great heroes, explorers. You made a great empire, but you've lost this about yourselves, and we need you to wake up a bit.
Bring it back. And one thing we've learned too is that the state is not our friend. Most of our governments are not our friends. So this is a big challenge we have. So I want to ask you, do you have any plans to go back to the UK? You're English. Do you have any plans to go back and fight for your homeland at some point?
At the moment, we will see. It really is kind of, it has been plaguing me. It hurts me very deeply, in all honesty, with Ilana. Really does. And you sort of end this toss-up where, it was in the immediate aftermath of Selner and Pettibone. I was like, right, okay, what can I do more? What can I do to try and save my people and save my country? And you kind of go, right, okay, so you go back, you write what you write, and, I mean, I can make myself pretty much invisible online with the help of my business partner. That's not an issue. But being anonymous in the real world there, that's going to be very hard. So I write what I write, and then, well, I go to jail for hate crime, because, I mean, that's a subjective law in the UK.
Yeah.
It doesn't – if you are offended by what I write, then you can report me to the police. And even if they find that no crime has been committed, it is a hate incident. So just by your subjective reality. So what do I gain then? What do I gain? Okay, so what's my other alternative? I have to keep writing. I have to be free to do so. I have to essentially become... I don't want this, man, you know? I'd rather be, making up science fiction stories. That's what I want to do with writing. I don't want to write about politics and stuff. I do it because I have to, because no one else is, as far as, well, there's a few, but no one seems to be doing what I'm doing. So I have to be at least at liberty to write this kind of stuff. And then if I can become well known enough that, you know, if I get arrested, then at least there'll be a half a Selner on the well known oppression scale, then maybe the state won't be able to completely screw me.
Well, that's why it's good that more media outlets like yours, like ours, are popping up, because we need more of them. And there's only a protection in numbers when more of us are writing this kind of content and it's out there. I think that's a big plus for us. Also, what did you think about Dankula? I mean, the state is coming in there and saying what is funny and what is not, and what jokes you can and cannot make. It's absurd.
And without a single complaint. Sorry, there was one single complaint, which was from the chairman of the Scottish Jewish community, which represents just under 6,000 people. And they said, "Well, okay, you said the word Jews, but he's mocking Nazis. That's we've always mocked Nazis."
And even then, like. Even then, like, so what? Like, it should be free to tell a joke and make fun of anything. Ever
that well I mean like that would be nice, but like I actually it was a really interesting period, actually. There was with regarding the JQ, I'm relatively unwoke on that kind of stuff. I see why there's in-group preference, and I definitely think I see a strong in-group preference with the Jewish community. That's okay. I wish to be more overt with it. Apart from that, you guys, you do you, but please stop messing with us. but there was the Poles passed a law preventing people within their country from calling the Nazi death camps Polish death camps.
Yeah.
Right. And there was an extended campaign run by a Jewish lobbyist in the United States and also in Israel itself, saying, "Well, no, like we're going to call it Polish Holocaust. What are you going to do? What are you going to do?" And I wrote about this. And I said, "Look, Jewish hypocrites, how can you do this to Poland? There's more Poles on your roll of honor than anyone else." Within an hour, our AdSense was shadow banned. We stopped earning money within an hour.
Yep, that's all it takes.
We call Google straight up and said, "Oh, okay, can you give us a reason for that?" "Oh, yeah, that's an error. You just got to call them out on this stuff because they don't want to say, you know why. And with Dankula, that's what he fell foul of, effectively. He fell foul of the Jewish lobby in the United Kingdom, which I just find bizarre.
They're powerful, very powerful there, yes.
As I'm apparently learning. And it's really interesting when we can then go, right, okay, well, this is the effect of a powerful in-group. This is an in-group bias at work. Can we accept that? No, it's because he's a Nazi. Oh, my God. Like, this guy's a reforming communist, right? He's got a hammer and sickle tattoo on his chest. Like, do you think he's had this swing? To be honest, I'm not interested in, like, this anti-Semite thing. We can go counter-Semite and pro your own ethnicity and your own in-group, but that doesn't need to descend into overt bigotry, in my opinion. And unfortunately, if you're not able to criticize Jews for acting in the interests of Jews, but if they can criticize Western culture and demand open borders and such, which a surprising amount of liberal Jews do, then that becomes an imbalance, and it falls back into the what are you not allowed to criticize. And it seems to me that what is now getting defined as hate speech is generally what positions a nationalist would hold. So people who vote for Brexit are motivated by hate and hate alone, or they're stupid, or they were brainwashed. People who want control of their borders, that's hateful as well. People who say, "Well, okay, can I have an English identity, please?" Well, that must mean that you hate all other identities. It doesn't mean that at all. I'm absolutely uninterested in wasting my time hating people. What's the point? You know, and it's like I would be more than happy to have the vast majority of people who are already living in Britain to remain there, provided we could, you know, maintain the ethnic maximalism.
Force a bunch of different people together and then you keep blaming the host population for all these problems, hate's going to happen. I mean, hate happens in every population. It happens in all white populations, all Asian populations, all black populations. It's a mm-hmm. natural mm-hmm. human emotion. They're never going to do away with that.
For sure. I mean, this was something that that Douglas Murray brought up in he's a fantastic writer. I don't know if you've read Islam. It's the strange death of Europe, Islam, identity, and migration, I think in that order. And one of his points was, when we had the IRA, which is the Irish Republican Army, whether you agree with their aims or not, they were brutal guys, brutal. And there was a chap who Douglas knew quite well, who infiltrated the IRA, and got to quite high up in their command and was feeding information back to the British state the whole time. When he died, a newspaper in Boston, the Boston Globe, basically denounced him as a grass, as scum, and so on. And you think, right, okay, well, this is his thoughts, not mine. And it's quite salient, I believe. This is a population of Irish people that left several centuries ago but retained their Irish identity. And when we had the Troubles, which was, you know, several decades of terrorism and violence, and my people are definitely not without blood on their hands, they remained convinced through their ethnic identity that the IRA were genuinely their guys and they should be supported. And you know, it's the my country right or wrong kind of argument. So why would we expect things to be less protracted when you have immigrant populations that still retain their identity to this day. They're not Irish Americans with some kind of illusion about the homeland. These are people from the Muslim world, the Dar al-Islam, which have a much stronger identity. They are part of the Ummah as it exists. And so you're going to expect these people just to toss away that? Not going to happen. Not going to happen at all. And it's not just delusional. I think it's quite bigoted to think that they would adopt your values instead of their own. I mean, I don't adopt the Ibithenko values here. I live in Ibiza. I live under their laws. I do not vote. I will not wish to change their culture at all. It's a fantastic island with fantastic people. And I want them to remain that way. And if they say, hey, man, we're going to get rid of all you English guys. You cause too much trouble. Off you go. Okay, I'll leave. No problem, man. But thanks for letting me live here. Your island, mate.
You're European, you know, that's how we think.
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, I feel I was born on an RAF base in Germany. My future wife is Polish. My kids will be half and half. But they're going to have, we're going to instill in them a sense of identity for sure. Come on. Why wouldn't you?
Well, Ash, thank you for your time today. It's been great getting to know you and learning about the website. So we'll, and for this time, then we'll have you back another time.
That'd be fantastic. Thanks, Lana.